The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome this morning. And all of you who are joining us from where you are. We're concluding a week-long session, meditation intensive, that we do each month. And because we're an Anga, we're concluding it with Dharma encounter. And I think most everybody is familiar with this, so I'm not going to sort of introduce the history of this, but just get right into it. And what I wanted to take up this morning is to sort of continue from my talk yesterday. There was a master who, Ruayan, who would call out to himself, "Master," and then he would answer, "Yes." And in the koan I read from, it said, clear all the way through. And then he said to himself, "Do not be deceived by others." And he responded to himself, "Yes, yes." So I want to take that up. Last week's Teisho, I talked about the koan of the flag in the wind. Two monks arguing, is it the flag that moves, is it the wind that moves? Huenong came to them and said, it's the mind that moves. Zen Master Maozhen said, it's not the wind or the flag or your mind that is moving. And to remember that all the teachings and all the practices, although they can be taken up in a philosophical way, they can be sort of looked at intellectually, that's not their purpose. Their purpose is, let me respectfully remind you, life and death swiftly are of great importance and time swiftly passes by. Each of us should strive to awaken. That's what they're about. And so when we encounter a teaching such as that, wind, flag, mind, Ruayan calling out to himself, acting in ways, speaking in ways that are not ordinary and that are not immediately apparent. And they're not immediately apparent because they're speaking to our wisdom mind, our Buddha mind, which can function freely in the world of words and meaning. These teachers are functioning freely in those worlds. But they're speaking from a realm of non-conceptuality, of wisdom, a mind that is not measurable, quantifiable, and that is not accessed through our senses, and yet we rely on our senses to live. And so the question of what are our senses telling us about the world? How does our mind get involved in that? And is what we perceive as the world an accurate reflection of the world? Is it the world, actually? If it were, and we respond to it as a true thing, then we should be living in a great state of harmony and peace. That does not seem to be the case, which leads us back to the question of what are we calling the world? What is our perception? What is the mind? And that's what I wanted to look at in a particular way. Do not be deceived, Ruayan says to himself. Yes, yes. Which means I will not be deceived. As practitioners who we dedicate ourselves to living, practicing an enlightening path, taking up enlightening practices. We take vows to live that life. And we endeavor to do that in every direction, in every moment, in every interaction, in every thought, word, and gesture. And while we're doing that, we're still deluded. We still have attachments, we still have false views, we have habit patterns that go deep. We don't see clearly, and oftentimes we don't know that we're not seeing clearly. And so how do we practice this enlightening path from within the place where we are? Are you seeing things as they are, or are they just your projections? When something happens that is disruptive, is conflicted, is creating harm, that we are experiencing, is the fault within ourselves or within another? Is that the right question? Is there another question that needs to be asked? Where is the responsibility? I read from the passage of the Moon Fascicle that Dogen says, when the clouds fly, we see the moon moving. When a boat goes along the shore, we see as though the shore is moving. And in this way, the moon travels when the clouds moon, and it seems the shore is moving when the boat goes. And he says, the meaning of this is the clouds and moon travel at the same time. They're walking together. The boat and shore travel at the same time. They walk together. So what is this walking together? If we say that the problems that we're experiencing that are causing our suffering are in the world, then we're forever at the mercy of the world. We'll try and control it. We'll try and get away from it. We don't need to examine ourselves because the problem is out there. If we say that the problem is wholly within myself and the world has nothing to do with it, and that can easily lead to indifference, passivity, to not recognizing what needs to be addressed, to not studying our mind. How on this path where we are ceaselessly encountering the world, we're encountering ourselves, and with that mutual arising, right? We are constantly in a mutual arising relationship, relatedness, happening at the same time, walking together, as we encounter everything within and without. And within our commitment and our vows, how do we know when we're clear and can be confident in that? How do we know whether an action is or words are compassionate, arising from wisdom? Or are they arising from some self-grasping place? The precepts, the moral teachings are based in selfless compassion, acting for the well-being of another, not for reward or recognition. How do we know when we're bringing forth an action and are trying to help someone sincerely or alleviate suffering in a situation sincerely? How do we know if our action is selfless or if we have some personal agenda? How do we step forward, which is the Bodhisattva path, when we're not completely clear about that? And how do we step forward when we think we are completely clear about that? How can Ruiyan be so confident that he is not being deceived? What is the basis for that? Now, we could answer that in all kinds of practice-related ways. He's a monastic, he's a teacher, he's made vows, he has a commitment, and all of those are true, but that's not the place he's speaking from. How can he know that he is not being deceived? How can he know that he's not deceiving himself? So what is the practice of this and what is the fundamental ground of this? That's what I want to look at. Because it's not difficult to see how essential this question is. It comes up all the time, right? We want to be alleviating suffering. We don't want to be adding more pain and confusion. We want to be clear in our actions most of the time. We want to feel like we're doing the right thing. We're doing what is in accord with our vows and the Dharma. But how can we be confident about that? And what is that confidence? Is it trustworthy? So Sancho will begin as a chief disciple. Any of you who are participating in the Ango are invited to come and queue up here and bring forth what you'd like to say or ask or express. And I'd like to ask that those who did Dharma Encounter last month sit back, so folks who haven't had a chance to do it. And that if you're doing Ango but you're not a student, you're still completely invited to come and engage in this. This is a putting yourself on the spot kind of practice. Okay, so Sancho will give us an example of that. And he will do three bows. Everyone else will just do a single bow.
Sho Sanchi. Clear, clear, all the way through. You know, there are times when I feel that way, when I deeply feel that I'm clear and about whether something is true or something is not true. But there are other times when I don't. You know, I'll see, for example, tens of millions of people who firmly believe that an election was stolen. And I look at that and I think, is that true? And in my heart and mind, it's not true. And for me, that's fairly clear. Mm-hmm. But
is it clear just because you feel it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel it as well as, I mean, there's a whole mountain of evidence.
Okay.
will support that.
Okay.
But there's something else that, being a progressive tree-hugging liberal that I am, I see some progressive causes, which I don't want to go into in detail, but and I think, are those true? Should I just like blindly believe in that because, you know, I'm progressive? I label myself as a progressive. Mm-hmm. And like you just said, sometimes it's very hard to know.
Well, do you blindly believe in the Dharma?
No, I don't blindly believe in the Dharma, but I have faith, deep faith that the Dharma is true.
Based on what?
I don't know. I mean, I sometimes wonder why I've stayed here so long.
Then how is that not blind?
Well, it's faith more than blindness.
Yeah, based on what? I mean, when you started, you needed faith, right?
Yeah.
Because you hadn't practiced yet, but you've been practicing for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So is that faith based on anything more?
Well, I can have faith in people that came before me, like you, and Hogan and Hojin, and a host of other people. And
has anything happened in your life that helps you to have faith? It seems I must ask that question.
Yes. You know, it's just the longer I...
What was the answer?
What was it? What do I have?
Has anything happened in your life since you've been practicing that has affected that faith?
Yeah.
Like?
Well, just having, like I was saying this morning, it's very subtle to my experience of it and of the Dharma and of Zen practice. And, you know, I get these experiences where I'll be in a situation with someone and maybe there's a little friction going on there and I'll handle it in a way and I'll think later, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, I would have handled it very differently. I would have gotten in that person's face. And I see that, and it's just, to me, that's a realization experience.
Okay. So let's go back to the feeling, okay?
Uh-huh.
You said sometimes you feel like, what'd you say at the very beginning?
Well, sometimes I feel like I know what's true, and,
that's right.
And sometimes I don't.
Okay. So feelings are very strong. We have them, and in a way we rely upon them. Are they always trustworthy?
No.
How do you know that that feeling is trustworthy?
Because I've had times when I've really felt like something was true and I've been blindsided by the fact that it's not true.
And what happens when you have to respond to something and you don't have that feeling? What do you rely upon?
I don't know. I mean, I just sort of... You mean in an urgent situation?
In any situation where you need to respond, you're being called to respond, and you don't... Feelings come and go.
Yeah.
That's their thing, right? They're impermanent, and they're also fickle.
Yeah.
Right? And so if we feelings, when they're true, when they're actually in accord with what is true and they're strong, they can be very powerful. But if we rely on them, sometimes they're not trustworthy and we don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're not there to be relied upon. You don't have that feeling. So now what do you do? What do you turn to? What do you move forth from?
I guess just trusting that, you know, during Sushin, there was someone that was irritating me. and then one day I just had, it wasn't a feeling, it was just, you know, I don't know what's going on with that person. You know, how can I judge them? Mm-hmm. I can't. And it wasn't a feeling that came up like, oh, they're probably pretty nice. It wasn't like that at all. Mm-hmm. It just sort of like settled into me that that's, you know, maybe I should just shut up because I don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe they are not irritating you.
Right. Maybe.
Could that be possible?
That could be.
Okay. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
When Rayon said clear all the way through, he had just called out Master. What is that? And what does that have to do with not being deceived? It's easy to, as I said yesterday, it's very easy to understand this koan in an ordinary way. Oh, I'm the master, right? You're the master. We're each in charge. No one can do this for you. You have Buddha nature. All of those things are true, but that's not what Rayon is doing here.
So, Shanti.
So, yesterday you recounted Taito messing up. I even remember it somehow. And it recalled to me...
What are you messing up?
Taito. He messed up. He got scammed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. He got messed up. Mm-hmm. He just... Somebody called him and was in need. And
he messed up. Yeah, speaking of kind of vernacular.
Okay, but for all the people who weren't here.
Yeah, oh, right. For all the people who weren't here, he got scammed. And I want to briefly.
Well, first, just to, for the record.
Yeah.
He was appealed to by a stranger.
Right.
Who was in need.
Right.
And he believed this stranger.
Right.
And he sent him money.
Right.
And then he realized
right.
that it was a scam.
Right.
Okay. It happened in that order, and that's important.
Thank you for that clarity for everyone who's listening. So very briefly, I was in Beijing, of all places, once, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was in Tiananmen Square, and I was wandering around in samsara, you might say, and a woman of about 30 came up to me, and I'm a pretty savvy traveler, and I'm from New York, and I've been around. And I'd already been approached.
New Yorkers think they...
Yeah, well, they do, they do. And they get fooled more than anyway. There's only a couple of guys, hustlers, who would approach me. Okay, so she was kind of in a bad business suit, and she had kind of granny glasses, and she came up, and it's the oldest dodge in the book, I want to practice my English. Ah, come on, you know, give me a break. I mean... But
so where did this all go?
Where this all went was to a tea shop eventually. Let's go to a tea shop. She was talking about living with her parents and so on. And it was really interesting and pulling me in and kind of poignant. And when I got to the tea shop, I noticed that there were some kind of shadowy figures in this tea shop. And some of them were not small. And we had some tea and we talked some more and I signed the check. And when I got back to my hotel room, I realized that that tea cost $200 mm-hmm. when I did the currency. Mm-hmm. So the reason I bring it up is compassionate action is non-dual action. Deception, non-deception, all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. and Rian was acting out of the place where he is deceived. He can be deceived. There's no question as a human being on that level, he can be deceived. The wrong three-card Monte game in Greenwich.
So why did he say, I will not be deceived?
Because from the absolute, there's no deceiving or not deceiving. There's no not deceiving and no deceiving. It's all one thing. And we can't be here. Nobody in this room, everybody in this room was calling out. Because we're all calling Master. Everyone in this room who's calling out to Master is in samsara and has been deceived. We have deceived others. But in that absolute place, astonishingly really, there's deception and no deception. There's no deception and deception. So, you can't have the one without the other.
So how does not being able to be deceived help you when there's somebody calling to you?
I need to know that there's a adamantine place because I've experienced it fleetingly.
But there's somebody in front of you asking for something and you don't know.
No, but...
So how does that wisdom help you?
It helps me not at all, because the fact is, in that moment, I'll make my decisions as to whether it's a scam or not.
Just based on your old street
smarts? Yeah, based on all that malarkey.
So, forgetting the self, realizing Buddha mind has nothing to do with it.
I bet if later this afternoon somebody tried to pull a scam on me on 6th Avenue, I'd react more compassionately than usual.
I hope you do. I hope we all do. But are you saying that realizing Buddha mind has nothing to do with it, of that very moment?
Realizing Buddha mind has everything to do with everything, but I think you can still be in that compassionate action a partaker of deception and non-deception and writing the check.
Yeah, okay. But the question stands. How does, if we're here sitting a whole week to realize self-nature, right, and to bring forth compassion and all the Buddha Dharma is, and to realize self-nature, why is that important?
Because
the question stands. May your life go well.
Thank you for your answer.
So, Sanchi, I have a question which probably doesn't have a whole lot to do with Rayon, but when thinking about what others were saying about Rayon, he seems to have had a supreme degree of confidence. He picked and he chose, in a way. And one thing that's been giving me quite a bit of mind flapping lately is this. It was from last year when we did the study on the Mind Faith poem. You know, this whole idea of picking and choosing, you know, the discriminating mind. And I'm the sort of guy that likes to, I kind of go either way on things. I either pick through evidence and I go, okay, I'm going to make this database decision and be very scientific about it and paralyze myself by analysis. Or alternatively, if it's something that really appeals to the flesh, I'll just jump in hands and feet and forget the brain. I've left it on the shore.
So you're two kinds of guy.
Two kinds of guy, yeah, I guess so. Very dualistic, I guess. But, so how do I find that happy medium where I don't pick and choose, but at the same time, I'm picking the right thing, which is still picking and choosing?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why that Faith Mind poem is so important in all of the teachings, because they're acknowledging that we, you know, you have senses, you feel hot and cold, you taste sweet and sour. You know, there's the light of day and the dark of night. And so that's how we live. That's how we interact with the world. And so, and on the basis of that, we know how to get out of a room or how to, when to pick up a pen and when not to. And so what does it mean to not pick and choose? What is when love and hate are absent? He's not saying to live in a world where there is no love and hate, but how do you love? What is your hatred? What is a choice, what we call a choice? What is desire? What is the nature of it? If we don't examine that, then the desire has a great deal of, seems to have a great deal of power, right? And so rather than think in terms of balance, although balance is good, the Buddha said it's more profound than that. It's more of a revolution than that. It's actually a middle way. And that is not a matter of balance, but it's a matter of realizing that all things, as Dogen says, the single mind holds all things. All things return to the single mind. And so, you know, what is the basis? So you said Rayana is picking and choosing. I disagree, but we will save that for another day. But what is this master? In the world of the 10,000 things, actions, movements, decisions, everywhere, is there a place of rest? Is there a place of not creating? When we begin to see in our zazen that we are, when you sit there and you suddenly have a little bit of movement in your leg, and you think, oh, it's pain, and then you think it's coming, the period just started. It's going to be terrible. And the pain gets worse and worse, and you think more and more. We should notice that. The direct relationship between the movement of our mind and the actual experience of that pain. It's not that we're making it up, but we are very actively involved in creating our experience of it. That should get our attention. If that's happening all over the place, right? What about that? And so that's why the Buddha said, in a sense, he's asking us to do something very difficult. He's asking us to stop, to pause within a burning house. And rather than just running around and looking for the fire extinguisher, we're trying to figure out who started this fire, right? And there are many things that we will need to attend to. He's saying in the middle of that fire, pause and sit down and find out what is fire.
Thank you for your teachings.
Shosanji, I don't think I've ever felt so alive as this moment right now. So this question you hold is really alive for me as well. And I feel it in me in the way I landed here for the first time a year ago, and within 6 months, I left 33 years in Colorado and moved next door in order to practice. And there are many in my life from those 33 years who think I'm getting scammed. There are those who think it's folly and frivolous. And I know there are those who think I'm running away. Mm-hmm. And what
I remember thinking, is she clear about what she's doing?
So what this has had me reflecting on is in 20 years of living in the Dharma, but seeking in the Dharma, when I landed here, I felt like I finally could see myself with fewer obstructions. And I, 3 months in to being here, I was talking with a friend who does know the Dharma, and in just trying to point to what I was discovering, she said, well, you know, it sounds like you're really growing in your trust of the teacher and the Sangha. And I paused and I thought, and I said, I actually am growing in my trust for myself. Mm-hmm. But as I've been thinking in the last day, I've been like, and it's also teacher Sangha and itself.
Yeah, it's all important. It's all important. Because that's why the Buddha said, you know, to be within the company of noble friends. You know, we live in this world, we dedicate ourselves to all sentient beings. Which means we need to also be in the company of people that may not be noble friends. They may have very different views, very different priorities, see the world in very different ways, have very different concepts of what's important and what's valued. And we may see that and accept that. We may see that and disagree. So we need to be able to be in all of this. But it is helpful to be in the company of people that you have some trust in, so that you can trust yourself being in that place and develop your own trust in yourself, our own trust in ourselves, and rely on each other, because we do actually need to do that. You know, that when you say something, that I trust that you mean that and that you will follow through if you say you're going to follow through when you take vows. And at the same time, I know that you're a human being, and so that when you misstep or you forget or you act out, that doesn't, you know, that my trust in you isn't conditioned on you acting in the way that I think you must act, right? It's that you are the whole of you. And that when you or I or any of us don't act out of that more noble place, that more vow-based place, that we should recognize that. That is recognizable, right? We have been that person. We are that person, right? And it needs to be attended to. There needs to be accountability. Sometimes it needs to be taken up, you know, in a repair and restore kind of way. But that trust can include the world that each person lives in and have some understanding. You know, we don't need to know the whole story that each person has. We will never know what someone's inside experience is. But when we understand our own mind and our own delusion, we understand a lot about mind, the minds of all sentient beings. We understand a lot about karma, and we can understand how we ourselves and other people can act and believe and speak in the ways that they do because it makes sense to them in the same way it makes sense to ourselves. And that doesn't mean that it's just all okay and that everybody lives in their own relative world, right? Buddhism has never taught that. That is completely consistent with having a very clear sense of what is affirming of life and what is destructive of life. It's not that complicated. Right? What is respectful and sees the dignity in beings, in life, in life forms, and what is not. And when it is not, if we trace that action back, we will always find a self-cherishing desire that wants something and places that desire above and beyond another's well-being. And that's our bodhisattva vow.
So the master calling out, it felt like me calling to myself, but it felt so unselfish. Is that what that's pointing to?
It's moving in the right direction. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi, when I'm doing something, when I'm offering myself, there's different ways I can experience that. If I'm offering myself to others, I can experience it in my body where it's open and it's immediate and it's not questioning. And other times I can be doing something and offering and see there must be something else under there a little bit, mm-hmm. You know. And that's a little bit about me. Mm-hmm. So I guess the way that I know, I trust that it's not about me is how it's in my body. It's how I feel in my body-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, you want to sort of be very attentive to that, very attentive. But you know, all of the kleshas, all of our attachments and false views are resident within the body. They show up in exactly through the same medium.
Yes.
Medium, right? And so that's where, you know, to just rely on a feeling, this feels right, right? I remember I read years ago a teacher who said, first thought, best thought. And I thought, oh, okay, I get that. So whatever my first instinct or impulse, go with that, because it's true. And pretty quickly I realized, no. That is not true so much of the time. And so, and in a sense, what I understood was what I was responding to was not actually first thought. What I was responding to was way down the line. Mm. And so that's what makes this so compelling, right? Is that one of the aspects of the Bodhisattva path is being willing to take a step forward, being willing to make the first move. You know, it's like we're coming together, something's happened between us, like, you go first. No, you go first. No, I'm not going first. You go first. Mm-hmm. And then here we are back in it. Mm-hmm. I'll go first. I'm sorry. And so to be willing to make the first move and to do that knowing that you're not entirely clear, that's wisdom. That is an aspect of wisdom. You know that you're not entirely clear. Wendell Berry says, you know, we're always learning something new. We're always seeing things we haven't seen before, which means we're always functioning with some degree of delusion and ignorance. How should we then do this? He said, with humility. Yeah. Think of the other side. Arrogance thinks, no, I got this. I know it. I know what's wrong with you. I got the solution. Right? We know how that works out.
Right.
And so when we know that we're not entirely clear, but clear enough, right? Because you're needed. Something is calling. And so to go forward, you go forward in a different way. Because now you are trusting yourself, you are moving with confidence, but you're also awake because you know. And it's just in general, it's just a good practice policy to assume we're not clear all the way through. Yeah. Right?
Yes.
Because if I think, no, I am, you know, we may already be in trouble. And not as a form of self-doubting, but just in a form in the sense of the depth and breadth of reality. How could I be entirely clear that I'm entirely clear? Right? And so, and that's a very, very much more compassionate. That is a form of compassion, right? And then when I step forward, there is cause and effect. And so you keep paying attention because that's your practice, right? And then you read the signs and they will show you, right? We will see. It may be immediately, it may be down the road, where we were clear and where we were not clear. And then we use that, right? We learn from that. Right. We take that in.
Yeah.
May your life.
Thank you for your teaching. So, Shanti, I know I'm moving forward in more accord with the world when I bring my practice off the cushion into the world and allow the space and not be pulled by my thoughts or judgments.
Mm-hmm. Good. Anything else? How is it when that's not happening?
Reactionary. Usually gets me into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Right. So as you know, I talked about recently, you know, that's how it goes. And so we have to, on this enlightening path, right, we have to also practice our transgressions, our missteps, our reactions, right, our attachments that are still active. And, you know, to realize we're not in a Dharma bubble, that when we do that, even with the best of intentions, we can still be creating harm, right? And that's real. And so, and that we have a responsibility in that, right? And so it's not that because I'm a Dharma practitioner and, you know, I'm on this enlightening path that I get a pass, you know, with my confidence and stepping forward, because that's my vow, and with my lack of clarity. And it's not about success and failure. It's just, this is just how the path unfolds for everybody. And so that, you know, it's like intention and then there's impact. You know, my intention is clear, I think, but the consequences were not what I wanted. So something wasn't clear. Maybe my intention wasn't clear. Maybe there I didn't have enough information. Maybe I just wasn't skillful. That's my study, right? But that's part of the responsibility, is taking responsibility for what I've created, which particularly when we've taken vows and care, it's more painful. It hurts more, right? I mean, when somebody trusts you, when somebody trusts me, and I don't live up to that trust, that is very painful, right? To know that I have injured that person's trust, which is why I think of our trust with each other as a sacred thing, you know? And it can and needs to be restored. And so that's, so we don't stop, right? Karma doesn't stop just because we're hurting, right? It continues within that hurt. And in that hurt, we actually become more vulnerable, more susceptible to more reactions, right? To more missteps if we get mired in it. And so how do we take responsibility at the same time but not get mired, right? How do we feel deeply so that we're motivated to learn and study and respond well and clarify, clear all the way through. And at the same time, you know, to not be avoiding anything. That is the middle way, right? It's more than anyone expects, right? I mean, it's asks of us what we are actually. And that is more than any of us imagine. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanji,
let the old Buddha come up. On the chair. Go ahead.
I think that calling to yourself is mostly to not fully yourself calling to yourself. And what I mean by that is that it's a calling for you to become aware of yourself at that moment. Where are you? Who are you? I know for me, the longer I've been here, the more that question becomes alive. Who are you? Who are you? The more I investigate it, the less I know. Mm-hmm. And the more that question becomes larger, because what you don't know enlarges it. You know, there's an interesting moment in the Bible, and when God calls out to Adam, "Adam, where are you?" If you think about it, God clearly knows where Adam is. It's really for Adam. Where are you? Where are you?
Yes. And what's, as you're saying, that calling can begin in a very, in one way, let's say. And because you're calling, and because there's a genuine seeking in that calling, that can lead you into a whole other worlds of calling, right? And so in the beginning, it may be very much based in myself, mm-hmm. right? And even a certainty about that. And that as we go, we truly do not know what lies ahead, right? Yeah. We cannot know. In a way, I was telling somebody during the week that, you know, sometimes when very strong emotional things arise, particularly during session, sometimes we can make a clear sort of causal link. And sometimes it's not clear at all. And I remember having experiences like that that were very tumultuous, very sort of volatile experiences, emotions, and sometimes having no idea what was going on. And I remember thinking once, maybe it's none of my business to know that. Can I trust? I knew I wasn't crazy, and I trusted the Dharma, and I thought, maybe that's enough. Very life cool.
Thank you for your teaching.
Sure, Sensei. It's nice to be up here. I say, I will be fooled by others.
Say more. Thank you for your offering.
Knowing there are no others, I vow to save them all. Each one.
So how will you be saved? How will you be fooled?
Sometimes I think this, others. Mm-hmm. So seeing as best I can, no others. No others. Still, mm-hmm. I'll vow.
The very thought of saving is a necessary deception.
Yes. I'm fooled all the time.
Yes. So, what about others' deceptions?
I have to walk the line that you just pointed at. None of my business, completely my business. I don't always know. I try. And sometimes I really screw it up.
Mm-hmm. And what in that, what's the theme? I mean, what's at the heart of what allows for that screw up, as you're calling it?
I love you.
Well, but how does that lead to undesired consequences?
I'm just a human being doing my best. And sometimes I'm not skillful. Mm. Sometimes I'm ignorant. Mm. And when he says, yes, yes, that's not an answer. That's a open question. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what we call or see as love is not entirely love.
I can hold that. I can hold that. Mm-hmm. And allow that to be within love as mm-hmm. well.
Yes, you can hold it. Ruayan knew that. The Buddha knows that. Right? That's one of the things that the Bodhisattva, that the enlightened mind and the enlightening mind offers to others, is knowing that each moon, each being, each Buddha can hold it. And they, whether we know that or not, whether we are manifesting that or not, That's clear all the way through. That is master. Yes. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Being an old Buddha, by the way, is a good thing. I was reminded of, I was sharing with somebody earlier, we talked about old, and I remember reading Annie Dillard when I was in high school, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, I believe it was, and she talked about finding a spider that only had 5 or 6 legs, and she said, you have lived. And I thought that was so wonderful. It's like the scars, right, the wounds, the missing appendages, the burdens you have lived.
Shosanchi, I call out with my one true voice, Master, Master. I answer, and it fills the universe. Yes. Do not be deceived by others. I will not.
How do you know?
It's unfolding. It's unfolding.
The merging. How do you know the merging?
Master!
How about when I deceive you?
Then we have to have a conversation.
What kind of conversation?
A live conversation.
In what kind of language?
Intimate language.
How do you know if I'm understanding?
Funny, hard to say.
Cat got your tongue?
What tongue?
You know, all of those expressions of gratitude that come up during Open Sosan, of love, loving strangers. What kind of madness is that? And that there is something that is calling and being answered, subtly sent out and perceived. And if you try to explain it, it all comes apart. And yet sometimes it needs to be so. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
One of the exquisite aspects of the Dharma is that it asks us, in a sense, asks us to ask of ourselves that we do things that in an ordinary way can seem very difficult or even counterintuitive or wrong, that we would set aside every concern for the world so that we can discover how to have profound concern for the world, that we can let go of every word and thought so that we can bring forth one of the most powerful forces we have in the world, which is our thoughts and words. How to be in utter solitude, alone, calling Master, with no one to answer, so that we can know what intimacy is. To realize that we live in a world that is so profoundly bound up together, and how deeply we rely on each other, which means that every living thing is relying on us to show up well. And when we understand that the truth of that, and that we are living in our own worlds of our bodies and senses, and that that has to be harmonized, and that the profound nature of the middle way is that whenever we would think that something negates another thing, that this thing leaves behind that thing, that doing this means not doing that, Master Dogen says it is alone and full and all-inclusive. And he really meant that. And he was not expressing his opinion. But rather was expressing exactly. And so I want to end with, let Master Dogen speak of it. The way of seeing mountains and rivers differs according to the type of being that sees them. And these different ways of seeing are the conditions under which water, life, wisdom and compassion, everything is killed or given life. The different ways of seeing are the conditions under which suffering is created, suffering is liberated. If we reflect on the real import of this, although we may say that there are different types of water, different types of beings, different types of worlds, it might seem that there is no original world or self or water, or no water or self or world of various types. But nevertheless, the waters which vary in accordance with the different types of beings don't depend on body or mind. They don't arise from karma. They are not dependent on the self or the other. And in this way, they are liberated. That within the profound teaching of dependent origination, all things that we perceive arise together. And so that is why, when suffering is created across the country, or across the world, or across the street, and you feel that pain, it's because that suffering is being created altogether. And when you or someone else acts in a way that is healing of that pain, and it comes into your awareness, and you feel the healing, the inspiration of that, that's because we're liberating ourselves together. And that's why Dogen says we should concentrate every effort on understanding this question and then concentrate still more. Have you ever thought in your practice, in a difficult moment, why can't you just forget all about this? Go home, turn on the TV, open a beer, right? Just forget about it all. I have. Not recently, but. And that's a kind of calling out. And the answer was very clear. Why don't I do that? Because I can't. I could, but I can't. That's not a life. Right? That's not the life I want. And so then I take on, that means I take on, rather than taking on that burden, and I know about that burden, I take on this burden. Of wanting to know, of wanting to go all the way through, of meeting everything that is difficult inside and outside, and finding my way in that. And my vow is to relieve myself of the idea that that is a burden. May our lives go well.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.